Thank you for listening to All Things Big and Small, ATBS, the podcast. My name is Keith Gorman, good friend of Jeff Vollmerich's. Jeff's doing some wonderful things. I encourage you to become a patron. Go to atbs.com and click on the patron link. Now back to the program.
Welcome to ATBS, the podcast, all things big and small. I'm your host, Jeff Vollmerich. In the upcoming episode, Keith Gorman sits down in the host seat to have a conversation with me. So we've turned the tables. We decided that it's a 90-minute conversation. It would be wise to break it into two parts. So the episode you're about to hear is part one of Thriving with guest host Keith Gorman. I hope you enjoy it.
So here we are, ATBS, the podcast, all things big and small. My name's Keith Gorman, and I have the pleasure today of introducing you more completely to Jeff Vollmerich. I had the pleasure of meeting Jeff Vollmerich probably for the first time back in our college days, back at St. Lawrence University. I was the ski team captain at the time, and I was meeting freshmen that had been brought in, and there were some freshman skiers on the team that were ski jumpers, Nordic ski jumpers. I remember Jeff Vollmerich coming in and Chris Hastings, another great ski jumper, and these folks had talent beyond belief, and we thought as alpine skiers that we could get things done, but these guys were really getting things done. And it was probably my first experience with Jeff, and Jeff was at the time bigger than life and still remains that way today. And so here we are, we're at the ATBS pod ship, and very happy to be here with Jeff. And Jeff, let me just start off with, how is it that you arrived in Park City?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on ATBS podcast.
Love having you on your show.
I'm glad to be here in the pod ship and have the tables turned. It's fantastic. Park City is home and has been for 28 years. Prior to that, I lived in Lake Placid, New York. I've always had roots there. My family's had a place on an island in the middle of the lake for 125 years. We celebrated that last year. And so, you know, growing up in Lake Placid or moving to Lake Placid full time when I was 10 years old, 1974, I was a 10-year-old skier. So I had learned to ski in Western Pennsylvania, and I was a skier. And if you look at any 10-year-old boy out on the mountain, they're bouncing and jumping and skiing that terrain like we don't ski at this point. They see it differently. And we moved to Lake Placid and, oh, there were ski jumps. And that's attractive to a 10-year-old knucklehead on skis. And so I started out on what ended up being an 18-year ski jumping career and being based in Lake Placid. One of my guests last week was Billy DeMong, who is the executive director of USA Nordic. There are only 30 places in the country that have ski jumps, legitimate ski jumps in the backyard today. That wasn't the case many years ago, but I was fortunate enough to be in Lake Placid and have that really exceptional youthful experience as a ski jumper. And that's a whole story unto itself. But I finished up in 88. I thought I was finished, and I did kind of retire after that in 89. And then I had some unfinished business due to a passion for life and a propensity for a little bit of drink and some entertainment and things like that.
Before we move on to that, Jeff, though, let me just point out that the level of your ski jumping was well above average. I mean, you were skiing on the World Cup level, the highest level of ski jumping in the country, and you were competing on behalf of your country. You are representing the United States. You are on the U.S. ski team, the U.S. Nordic ski jumping team. And I also recall that you held the record on the 90-meter ski jump in Lake Placid. Is that correct?
What is now called the 90-meter. Then yes. We used to call it the 70-meter.
Yes.
Yeah, 92 meters on the 70-meter, and I held that record, and it was my favorite place to jump. It was home territory, right? That 70-meter jump was home base for me. That jump and a jump in Brattleboro, Vermont, were my two favorite ski jumps in the world, and I had some of my greatest experiences on those hills. And so, you know, I'm being interviewed by one of my very dear friends and one of the humblest human beings I know. And I've learned a lot over the years, learned a lot about humility from my father, right? He always said, Jeff, you know, you may be good, but there's always going to be somebody chasing you. So don't get too high on your horse. Don't get too high on yourself. And that lesson has stuck with me. So, you know, hearing that, you know, you deliver, you know, those accolades or what have you, it's humbling. And it was spectacular, right? It was a real joy to grow up in a place like Lake Placid, where there were Olympic heroes in the sport of ski jumping. Jay Rand was my hero, and he lived right down the street, and he'd gone to the Olympics at 16 years old, and he'd been to two Olympics by the time I showed up on the scene. And so there were people there that you could look up to. And then the Olympics came through Lake Placid when I was 16 years old, you know, the Miracle on Ice and Eric Heiden and all my ski jumping heroes came through town. And it was like, oh, well, that's where I want to go. That's what I want to do. I think I already knew that. You know, we started out in Lake Placid, and then we jumped around on the regional tour in the Northeast. And then we spread into the Midwest. And there was a little place in Madison, Wisconsin, where it was first place in the country to have artificial surfaces on a ski jump, you know, drive 24 hours and get out there and, you know, jump in the summertime. And great friends, one of whom you mentioned, Chris Hastings, we went to St. Lawrence at the same time and remain wonderful friends. And, you know, went from the Midwest and then got out to the West. I remember getting into the Rocky Mountains at about 16 or 17 years old. I was in the junior nationals and they were in Winter Park, Colorado. And I was floored, man. It was March, the blue sky, the white snow, the warm sun. And thinking back on it, I think that must have been a time when I realized, like, oh, I'd like to live there. I'd like to get West sometime. And, you know, many, many, many years later, I ended up in Park City, you know, but we went from regional to domestic around the country to all around the world for, you know, junior world championships and Europa Cup and World Cup events. And that was always coming and going. You had to earn your place onto the team and you had to keep it, which was sometimes seemed easier than others. And, you know, my good friend, Chris Hastings, and I think we viewed the sport as a bit of a combined event. You know, some people took their ski jumping extremely seriously, and we did, but we also felt like it probably was a good idea to get out and see what the local culture was all about as well. So a little combined event there. And, you know, it wasn't always the best course of action, but man, oh man, it was entertaining and educational.
So you look to excel on the hill as well as off the hill.
Yeah. And I felt like I did exceptionally well in the combined event on a regular basis. No question about it. You know, Chris and I were partners in crime and brothers in arms all the way through. And domestically, we traded off a bunch of competitions, you know, first and second place, and had a blast doing it. And you know, shooting for the Olympics. And 84 came around, Sarajevo. I wasn't in prime form. I was 21 at that point. And Jeff Hastings, who has our best ski jumping finish in the last 75 years, got fourth in those Olympics. And instead of the tryouts weren't going great for me. And so Jeff and I went to Japan. He was already pre-named and I knew I was going to make the Olympics. So we went over to Japan and competed in the World Cup over there. And I turned 21 in Sapporo, Japan, which was awesome.
And how'd that go?
That's well, I think it went very well. there were some others who didn't think quite so highly of my shenanigans, but you know, it was some of my early days of hanging out with the Scandinavians, and they know how to celebrate a 21st birthday.
So you were learning all the time. You started your learning at a young age.
I think I've had my eyes fairly wide open most of the time, unless they weren't. Okay. But But yeah, I was always curious. I very definitely am I'm a curious guy. You know, the unknown has never really been something that I've been afraid of. And a lot of that comes from ski jumping. You got to look down a hill and not be able to see where you're going to land. And I think that was a big part of how I've gotten to be how I am. And then 88, just to kind of wrap that whole ski jumping thing up, in 88, you know, we're ski jumping all the time. We're not just ski jumping every 4 years. Lots of people who see ski jumping on TV, they're like, oh, it's happening all the time. So it's a year-round proposition, and that's what you do. And I was focused on that. 88 had a great opportunity to make the Olympics, and my good friend Chris Hastings got the last spot on the Olympic team. And I narrowly missed by some really small margin of fractions of points out of many hundreds of points and things like that. It was pretty, felt like a really, really big deal at the time. In hindsight, with decades of, you know, perspective, it seems much less important. Chris is a wonderful friend of mine. He went to the Olympics in Calgary. People oftentimes will mistakenly say, oh, Jeff was an Olympic ski jumper. Well, I didn't make the Olympics. I strived for that. And, you know, I've said to many people over the years that, and I'm sure this was probably, they tried to instill this in me, but I wish somebody had said, Jeff, the U.S. ski team is not a big enough goal for you. And going to the Olympics is not a big enough goal. You should set your sights beyond that. Let's go to the Olympics and let's make some noise. Let's go to the Olympics and let's compete. And I suspect it was said, but maybe I wasn't listening. So then after the 88 tryouts and winter, I think 89, I retired, and I just felt like I had enough and it was time for a change. I moved down to Florida to get as far away from the snow as I could because we'd been chasing it for 18 years. And somewhere along the way, while I was down there, I came to the realization that it was time to stop drinking as well. So I had a very, what I consider to be a wonderful 10-year drinking career. You were familiar with it. And it was a great time in my life. I really wouldn't change anything, but I did stop, and I'm grateful that I did. So I quit drinking at 26, and I've got AA to thank for that, and a lot of great people around me, a lot of great love and support. And once I got sober, I realized that I hadn't finished the ski jumping thing on my terms. And so in the fall of 1991, I decided I would try out for the 92 Olympics. Or I'm sorry, in the spring of 91, I decided I would try out. And so I trained all summer in Florida and then did some ski jumping and training. And I went back up on those big ski jumps, and holy shit, what 18 months will do for the perspective, you know, when you're in your late 20s. And I found myself on the top of ski jumps thinking, what am I doing here? And tried out, didn't make the Olympics, and then ski jumped through that winter at some of my favorite places domestically, all over New England, out in the Midwest. And I had an absolute ball. And I wrapped up at a tournament called the Fred H. Harris Memorial Tournament in Brattleboro, Vermont, where to retire the trophy, which is a monster, you have to win the event three times. And I won it first at like 16 years old, and I won it again at 20. And I was pretty confident that I was going to take that beauty home. And it was really something that I strove for in my career. Didn't get that. You know, those are all learning experiences. I sold all of my gear out the back of my truck at the end of the Brattleboro tournament. And that was the last time I ski jumped competitively.
Wow.
So it was a great ride, great friends, great experiences. I wouldn't trade it for the world.
So then you took the ski jumping experience.
Mm.
And obviously you learned a lot. You were successful on and off the hill. You also were learning a bit about, probably early on at a young age, challenges and disappointments and the way to potentially handle those best or maybe not the best way. But then you ended up in Park City and I think started to share your knowledge and your experience. Do I have that right?
Yeah. I finished up my jumping in the spring. It was maybe February. I think the Fred H. Harris tournament is then. And I went back down to Florida and I spent some months down there. And realized that I'm not a Florida guy. I'm a mountain, snow, lake, streams. That's me. And I'd done enough of the Florida thing, and I felt like I needed to come back up out of there. And I made my way up through Georgia and into Kentucky, and had a nice soft place to land in Kentucky with my friend Jeff Camp, who at the time lived there, now lives in Park City. And while I was in Kentucky, I started to get wind through, I think, my mother, long before cell phones, that there was out in Park City, Utah, they were building some facilities in the hopes of attracting the Olympics. not in preparation for the Olympics, but for the first time ever, building venues in an effort to get the Olympics. And a guy named John Bauer, who had been Nordic program director for the US ski team, and he'd seen me go through my career. And then what he saw was me go back and finish on my own terms. And I gained, you know, a great deal of his respect through that effort and how I pursued that and how I conducted myself. And he was the first person hired at the Utah Olympic Park in Park City. I think he was hired in 91, and he had to put together a team of people to run a potential Olympic venue. And one of the things in Park City that hadn't happened in about 30 years was ski jumping. There used to be a very vibrant jumping team here, Alfangen. There's a great and rich ski jumping history in Utah, but there hadn't been ski jumping in 30 years. So they were looking for somebody to start some ski jumping programs and be a coach. And I interviewed, and John Bauer was the guy, and I got the job. And I was 28 years old. It was a 6 month opportunity, 6 month contract. Salary was $12,000. And my job was to start a ski jumping program in a state run facility. Or within a state run facility. And if anybody has ever tried to requisition a shovel from a state, it's in triplicate and it takes months and things like that. And we needed ski jumping skis and boots, and we needed all kinds of stuff. And they're like, can you get that down at Dick's Sporting Goods? And I was like, no, we're going to have to get that from Europe. And that doesn't fit into the state model. And at that time, I was in really early on, like literally the first weekend I was in Park City, I got volunteered by John Bauer to work at the now monstrously successful Park City Ski Swap. And it's been ongoing for 40 some odd years. And he volunteered me to help move in the gear and work the Friday night, which doesn't open until midnight or something. And that was my introduction to Park City and the people of Park City. And Russ Coburn and Jan Peterson, rest his soul, were at the helm of Jan's Mountain Outfitters at the time. And they took me under their wing. They took the program. Jan had been a ski jumper. He'd been a four event skier when he was a kid growing up in Utah. And they just said, man, whatever you need, and if we can help you get it, you just let us know. And there was another woman, and I'm going to have a hard time bringing up her name, but she at the time was at the helm of the Utah Winter Games. She also said, look, Jeff, whatever you need, if there you need bibs or you need this or you need that. And so we cobbled together a ski jumping program. I'd back my black van up to the side of the little jumps and turn on the music and let my Rottweiler Bear out. And we had a little horse trailer that had some ski jumping skis in it. And we started ski jumping. And to back up a little bit, when I got the opportunity, I was in Lake Placid, made my way up from Kentucky. And I packed up my black van and my windsurfer and my mountain bike and my dog, and I drove across the country and moved to Park City sight unseen and have found no compelling reason to leave in 28 years.
That's an incredible story, and it's really indicative of you giving back to a sport that gave you so much and is so representative of just you as a person, I think, but also the program that you built and the resources that you were able to corral in terms of surrounding yourself with people and resources. And I believe today that the Park City ski jumping program is probably one of the healthiest ski jumping programs in the entire country.
It's one of the good ones for sure.
Yeah, here in your other home stomping ground of Lake Placid.
Yeah, Lake Placid, Steamboat Springs, Colorado, and Park City, and then some in the Midwest too, but it's a really vibrant program. And one of my really good friends, longtime friends, Matt Terwilliger. In fact, he's the friend that I've known the longest. My family are the only people that I can remember knowing longer. Matt and I met when I was 10 and he was 7, and we were both ski jumpers, and he's up at the Utah Olympic Park now. He came out as one of my coaches years and years ago. And he's been spreading the good word and programming the facility and, you know, bringing in great coaches and thriving, right? So that place is jamming. And if you go up there any given evening in the wintertime, now there's ski racing and there's freestyle and there's slope style and there's Nordic ski jumping and freestyle aerial acrobatics. And, you know, it's so much going on up there. And I love going up and just checking it out, you know, plugging back in and, you know, people are like, oh, what are you doing here? And, you know, I just have an interest and watch from a distance. It's been great.
That's fantastic. And so you obviously end up setting up shop here in Park City. You get married, you meet your wife, Fiona. Fiona ends up moving to Park City. You have two beautiful daughters, Taylor and Savannah, and you end up raising your family in Park City. And you live a pretty incredible lifestyle. You've got the mountains here, you get to fish, you get to snow ski, and also you get to begin to work on your water skiing. Now, I've known you for more than four decades, and we have water skied together for a number of years, and, you know, admire the skill at which you water ski. And I'm bringing up the water skiing because I know how, again, as an older athlete, that, you know, how much you have to put into things to try to get results out of it, and the commitment and everything that you put into your water skiing and the success that you were having, competing extremely well. And, you know, I'm going to take you now sort of fast forward to 2016. And 2016, I mean, I remember talking to you just before you were getting ready to go to a pro-am. I believe it was out in
North Carolina. Little mountain, North Carolina. And I'd never been there. And I've water skied my whole life. Yeah. And, you know, my mother turned me on to it when I was a kid, growing up in Lake Placid. And it's always been a thing in my life. And I still go back to Lake Placid in the summer. And at one point, after I'd been in Utah for quite some time, I'd been here for 15 years, I think. Yeah, 13, 14 years. And we've got some reservoirs. You know, the Western United States is more reservoir rich than lake rich, right? You're from Central New York, a beautiful part of the country, and there are lakes all over the places and you know, glacially established lakes. And out west, if we don't dam it, there aren't too many lakes. So when I got to Park City, they were just filling the Jordanelle Reservoir, which is now a water playground paradise. And they were just filling it. And a buddy of mine, Greg Cutt, and I bought a Mastercraft ski boat, and we were partners on it for the next 12 or 14 years. I think we had two different boats. And we were skiing out on the Jordanelle. We'd go out early in the morning and go rip it up. And you practically had to wear a dry suit year round, because even though the water was warm, you'd go out there in the morning and at 6,000 feet in the mountains on the backside of the Wasatch, it's 38 degrees. And so there were literally summers where I didn't take my dry suit off because we were done by 7:30 in the morning. And at one point, I was back in Lake Placid, and these friends of mine, John Wilkins and Terrence Fogarty, looked at me. I think it was John Wilkins looked at me. He said, "Jeff, that 20-year-old ski that you're skiing on, it's got to go." And I said, "Well, what do you do?" And he said, "Well, you go talk to Terrence." And Terrence said, "Well, you got two choices. You can get a new ski, or you can get the new hard shell bindings. You could do both." That's what I chose. And I jumped on that new ski, and literally three turns in, I was like, this is a whole new game. And it really re-sparked my interest in tournament water skiing, which I'd done as a young guy in Lake Placid, kind of from 14 to 20. And I water ski jumped and I slalom skied, and a guy had come into Lake Placid when I was about 15, a guy named Bill Peterson, and he rocked our world, man. He knew everything about skiing, show skiing, slalom skiing, how to build a water ski jump. Like, he fired us up. He lit the fuse for us. And, you know, so I did that when I was in my teens and into my early 20s, and then ski jumped all over the world and wasn't able to do it as much. And when I got to Park City, continued my passion for skiing, but then it was just all free skiing out on the lake. And that was great. And, you know, not skiing around buoys and not jumping off jumps and stuff. And somewhere, you know, 12, 13 years later, John Wilkins says to me in Lake Placid, he said, "Oh, you know, there are a bunch of really good water skiers in Utah." And I said, "You know, I see some good skiers, but I'm pretty sure you're not talking about the ones that I'm seeing on the Jordanelle." And sure enough, you know, that is the case. There are some of the best water skiers in the world live in Utah. Nick Parsons, Chris Rossi, Nick grew up in Bountiful, Utah, and he was in the top 10 as one of the best professional water skiers for years, and still a ripping skier. And Chris Rossi lives here. And again, these guys were top skiers in the world. And so I went looking for those better water skiers, and I found them. And oh, lo and behold, there are all kinds of tournaments going on in Utah and high level water skiing. And I got invited in. I bumped into Nick Parsons at a ski lake in California that I had just gone out to for Father's Day to try out my new ski. Oh, you should come to, you know, Suntan and try our tournament on July 4th. And that was the beginning of a 10-year really solid run at tournament water skiing. And that was like 2009. And so I was 45 years old or something. Really, you know me well enough that, you know, if I find something interesting, I'm in, right? ATBS, the podcast. Sure. I'm in. Let's go long. Let's see how to do this. And tournament water skiing was like that for me. So I really dove in and skied all around the West and skied in tournaments back East and some regional tournaments and some pro-ams and some, actually I hadn't made it to the pro-ams, but I'd made it to the national championships and skied down in Ocala in Florida. It was just marvelous. It was like being a kid again. And so all of that is background to get us to 2016. And I was here at the house and the family was out of town and Fiona travels a bunch. And I got up in the morning and I was at a 4:30 flight down to North Carolina. And, you know, the day before I'd had a great training. I was skiing at the top of my game, best water skiing I'd done in my life. No question about it. And I started packing up in the morning and I just didn't feel quite right. And I had this little stitch in my side on my left side. And that was like 7:38. And you know how when you've got, Keith is a super humble human being and ski races and does a whole lot of things at a high level at his age, our age, a couple things that are a little different than me, but we share that commonality and that passion for self-discovery and pushing ourselves. And you know how when you're getting ready for a trip, you're fired up, right? Like you should be ready to go. And I was kind of kicking the tires a little bit. I didn't feel great. And from 7:30 in the morning until 11:30 in the morning, things kind of went downhill. And I was like, I think I better take a nap. And by 11 o'clock, I called Fiona. She was out in San Francisco. And I said, you know, my side really, really hurts. And it doesn't feel like a muscle. And it doesn't feel like a stomach ache. And then I was in the hospital by 1 o'clock that afternoon. And by 3 o'clock that afternoon, Fiona was home from San Francisco. And I went in for a CT scan. And you know, first they think it's kidney stones or something like that. And that's not what it was. And then, oh, we're going to send you in for another CT scan. And then Fiona was there. And that's when we heard the words, we're sorry to say that it appears as though you have cancer or something is very wrong with your kidney. And I saw the pictures. I was like, well, that doesn't look like a kidney at all. Right. The other one looks perfectly like a kidney bean. And, not to get into great detail, but that night was tough. They sent me home with some oral medication and it was not nearly enough. We were back at the hospital by 2 o'clock in the morning. By 5 o'clock that next afternoon, my left kidney had been taken out. And I had actually to back up to the evening before, they'd medicated me so that I could, function because the pain was really bad. And they delivered the shocking news, I guess. And he said, I'll give you guys some time to think about it and see what you want to do. And he walked out of the door and I looked at Fiona and she said, you want to go to the water ski tournament, don't you? I said, yeah, that's exactly what I want to do.
So you were thinking that you've just been told that you have cancer and that maybe if they take the kidney out, you'll still be able to make the tournament.
No, what I was thinking is that I was pretty heavily medicated and I'm not even sure that I'm not sure they used the word cancer at that point because I'm not sure we knew, right? But but clearly things weren't right. But at that point, he walked out and Fiona said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, what I really want to do is I want to go to that tournament. And the doctor walked back in and I said that to him. And he said, well, we could probably get you to the tournament, Jeff, but I'm not sure based on what we're going to have to put in you to get you there that it's going to work out that well. So I accepted the fact that I wasn't going to go to that tournament that I'd had my sights set on for freaking years. Because John Wilkins and Terrence Fogarty in upstate New York, every fall, they migrated down the East Coast to the warm weather, and Little Mountain was like a mecca. You could put up good scores. The water was kind. The driving was good. There were really good skiers there. So I was psyched to go, and I was skiing at the best that I've ever skied. And then, took a little kick in the gut, and had to take a few steps back.
So that was probably one of the first disappointments that you were about to experience, was not going to the water ski tournament. Then there was going to be some other news that was going to start to come.
Yeah.
And you were going to learn about a new challenge.
Yeah.
So tell us about that.
And you're going to have to go deep, right? And I think it was probably after that, after I'd been in the hospital the next day and had the kidney taken out. And I think we were home. Maybe we were, I don't know. I forget how it all works or the timing of it exactly, but it was all in pretty quick succession. And it was determined that I had papillary renal cell carcinoma, and my kidney and the cancer were mostly necrotic. So the cancer had eaten up the kidney, and that thing needed to come out. Fortunately, we have two, as we all know. And then I heard those, you know, you've got papillary renal cell carcinoma. Later, we determined that it was type one. And so that was the beginning of a whole new chapter in my life and our lives, Fiona's, mine, our daughters, my friends, you, things changed. I don't think I've changed that much. Well, actually, that's not true. Much of me remains intact and I'm very similar, but I've also, as we may get to, and people who know me know, I've been on quite a journey. And, you know, there are a lot of ways to go, I think, when one hears those words. And I only knew one way to go. And that was, you know, integrate the information and meet the challenge. And, you know, living life is what I do, right? I'm all in. I love it. And if there's something new to try and there's something new to do, then let's figure it out and let's give it a go. And maybe for not completely the first time in my life, but certainly one of the biggest experiences in my life was that I was going to have to dig in and learn about something that was non-athletic. I was going to have to dig into myself. I was going to have to go inward and figure out how to play the game. And I've said since then, cancer diagnosis, I, you know, if you want to dance, I'll dance. I don't see it as a fight. I don't like being a fighter. That is not to say that I resign myself to what cancer may have or people may have in store or what conventional medicine, and I participate in conventional medicine and conventional treatment. But I don't listen to, I'm not interested in labels and I'm not interested in statistics.
So you're delivered this news and you obviously set forth a course in your own mind that you're, you know, you have experience athletically with challenges and taking things on. And now you're, you know, you're on a whole new playing field. And again, from having attended university together, I don't think you were a science major. But very quickly, you were going to have to...
I did take geology, doesn't it?
Very quickly, you're going to have to get a lot of information, a lot of resources, and...
going to have to go back to being a student, right? And have a beginner's mind.
For sure.
Yeah.
And I think that early on, that you immediately were looking at, maybe we might classify it broadly as both Eastern and Western medicine.
Yeah, agreed.
And, you know, conventional Western medicine, obviously, you know, you partake in and I think has helped you.
Agreed.
But I think that the Eastern medicine and some of the alternative ways to go about treating cancer, you've done a lot of heavy exploring on that.
I have. And, you know, that came from, it hasn't all happened at once. You know, with hindsight, we can see, you know, we can see how things unfolded, and when they're unfolding, we're looking out the other way. And so for me, I guess much like when I showed up in Lake Placid and I looked at the ski jump that was out there at Interval, I was curious and like, how do you do that? How does one get to do that kind of fun thing? And, you know, water ski jump was the same way. And, you know, St. Lawrence and all the things that we got to explore, like, oh, how do we figure this out and play this game? And curiosity is something that I've had a long time. And so once I had to put my curiosity to work and go, okay, I need to be curious about this disease and I need to be curious, but more importantly, I'd like to be curious about how to thrive, how to live and you know, live a great life and continue on things that, you know, the way I'd been continuing all along. I also realized pretty quickly that you need to take control of your life and your health. You need to take responsibility for it. And about the same time, I learned that I needed to be practice forgiveness for myself. If I brought it on myself through, you know, lifestyle, and forgive myself and not beat myself up for something that maybe I did or didn't do that caused it. You know, it's hard to say. Then follow my instincts and learn and listen and research and ask questions, and lots of them. And one of the things I learned early on was you got to know who you're asking the question. What question are you asking, and who are you asking it of? And I think it falls into that category of, you know, it might be good to know the answer before you ask the question. And what I learned really early on was it mattered who I asked. So if I went to the Huntsman Cancer Institute, which I hold in really high regard, they've been beautiful to me and wonderful, and they do great work. But one of my early questions was of my oncologist, who I have to this day, and he's great, was, what do you think about diet, nutrition, exercise, and mindfulness as part of the package? And if I'm not mistaken, he said, you know, Jeff, I think you can move the needle about 1%. At that point, I realized that I don't need to ask that person those questions, because he's educated in a certain area and he's wickedly smart, spectacularly intelligent in the world of oncology and that Western medicine. And if I want to ask those questions and I want to get some real answers, I'm going to have to seek out some other experts, which I did. And I, that set me on my path of, where do you go and who do you ask? If you want to know about nutrition and cancer, and if you want to know about mindfulness and how powerful that is, then let's go talk to some people who really know. And I started that process that Christmas after things had settled a little bit. And I've got a story to come back to about time. But that Christmas, Fiona gave me a gift, and it was a gift, an invitation to visit Canyon Ranch in Tucson, Arizona. I was floored. She had been there many, many years ago after the girls were born, and she loved it from a health and fitness perspective. And Canyon Ranch, she said, Jeff, you know, I think they've got some programs down there, and they're tapped into some things that I think might be interesting to you. And I have her to thank for that. And sure enough, I went down there, and my intention was, it was February of 2017. And my intention was to go down there and find some spiritual stepping stones that I could begin to build a foundation on. And I learned some things down there that were, you know, absolutely spectacular. I was introduced to Qigong. I did some, you know, soul journeying. I did some, had some spiritual dialogue. I met my first integrative medical doctor. Oh, integrative medicine. And I sat and had a wonderful conversation. So I enrolled and engaged completely. And I was there for about a week, and it was really eye-opening. And that was really the first place that I got some answers. I was able to ask people really interesting questions, and they were experts, right? So it was meditation, it was Qigong, which is, you know, Chinese energy work, right? Qigong directly translated is Qi is energy, and Gong is work. And a guy named George Mira was teaching yoga classes. And one day I took 7 yoga classes. He was teaching all kinds of different esoteric yoga practices. And I already had my own practice to some degree, but that really opened my eyes to this Qigong. And I dove in with him and had a private and learned more about that. And I still practice that to this day. I would like to go back before we go forward to an experience that Fiona and I had sitting in our, where you were just standing a few minutes ago talking to Fiona. And it was right after my kidney had been taken out, and I was home and I was recovering, and she and I were, you know, looking at each other with that shocked, literally, holy shit, what now? And at that point, through that many tears and, you know, a realization that life had just changed pretty dramatically, and that we would sally forth. But I asked for some time. The one thing I asked for was time. And I said that to Fiona. I said, you know, I don't know how this is going to play out. We didn't have any information. Like, we didn't know anything other than it had been taken out. And at that point, you don't know if you've got months, half a year. And I asked for some time. And man, I've been granted some time, some really, really good time. And I've said to many people over the years that, you know, if she and I had been able to sit there and have a crystal ball at that point, and if somebody had said, and I haven't done the math lately, because I don't keep track, but at one point after I, you know, went past 3 years, I was like, well, I can do that math pretty quickly. That's more than 1,000 days. And if that crystal ball had said, you want some time? How about 1,000 days? I'd have snatched that up every day of the week, every time it came up. Thanks for listening to part one of Thriving with guest host Keith Gorman. A big heartfelt thank you to Keith for stepping into the driver's seat in the podship, turning the tables, asking some great questions, and engaging in really enjoyable conversation. Check out part two, where we head in some different directions and explore some other things that have been part of my life, and hopefully we can turn some lights on and encourage you to check out some different possibilities for health and wellness and exploration. If you'd like to learn more about what I'm up to with this podcast, atbsthepodcast.com, where you can learn about the direction I'm headed, what I'm trying to accomplish, building community, turning some lights on. You can support us, and I would be grateful. You can donate on the website. You can subscribe via Patreon. And I'd also like to give a shout out to my editor, Wyatt Schmidt, a multi-talented young man. And you can find him on Spotify at Wyatt Schmidt, S-C-H-M-I-D-T. Come on back and join us. And in the meantime, keep on thriving.